This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Over the weekend, a Seattle athlete had the chance to go into the record books. Saturday afternoon, the Washington Huskies were playing basketball here at home. Senior point guard Kelsey Plum was 54 points away. That's a long way away for one game. She was 54 points away from the all-time college women's scoring record. Seattle Times sports reporter Percy Allen was there. You didn't think this was going to happen that night, right?
Oh, no.
That day?
No, I don't think anybody did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. When did you realize she's going to do this?
Well, I thought—
All-time scoring leader.
Yeah, you know, right? So I thought right about the third quarter when she entered the fourth quarter with 38 points, and it was a relatively close game. And I'm thinking, oh, well, this might happen. And it was because, like, conditions were kind of perfect that it was the regular season finale. There was, like, 7,000 people there. It was a relatively close game because normally Washington blows people out, right?
Uh-huh.
And so she's, you know, like, by the fourth quarter, she's on the bench, you know, because they're up by 20 points.
Right.
And so they just don't need her. But not this game. I mean, this was kind of close. Utah was making a run at it. And Washington's other best player, Chantel Osahor, had fouled out. So now here's this, you know, sort of relatively close game, big sort of emotion going to it, and it just kind of felt like a crescendo type of a deal. And then I thought, you know what? Here we go. I mean, like,
I read your tweets. This is crazy. This is ridiculous. Call a friend. I think she's going to do it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that, like, you know, as any like sports writer can sort of relate to, is that you have one story in mind. And by halftime, you already kind of have started working on that story. Mm. And then you're like, you know what? I might have to delete this. And basically, I deleted, like, everything that I – and it's like, oh, I got to write another story. And really, just kudos to her that she also sensed the moment, too. And she is just one of those special type of talents, players who realizes what's going on. And rather than shrinking from it, just embraces it and lets it lift her to a different place. I mean, she'll tell you that she's never scored that many points in her life. Not even in high school, you know, when, like, you expect these really fabulous college players to, like, be able to dominate.
To dominate,
high,
yeah.
High school. She's never scored that many points. So like, that told me that she was... And I know this is going to sound so cliche, but that zone, you know, that like people talk about that zone. I've never been anything close to a zone. I don't even know what that feels like. But you hear people talk about it. Like, they get into that zone where, like, the, you know, they say the like, basket is as big as the ocean.
Yes.
And it really, truly felt, I mean, she was just jacking up shots like, that ain't going, oh, that's not, what? You know, I mean, just throwing things up, and it was truly cool to see.
I want to say more about Kelsey Plum in a moment, but part of the fun was your retweeting the people who are weighing in on this, Governor Jay Inslee,
yeah.
And on and on.
Yeah.
Kobe Bryant?
Yeah. So, like, that, you know, came, like, after the fact where,
yeah.
You know, where, like, you just have a chance to, you know, maybe sort of, like, take in kind of what's happening. And then you're, like, curious as to, did anybody else sort of watch what I sort of saw? And, you know, I'm not even going to try to lie. And, you know, I'm not a big social media or, like, Twitter person. So, you know, I just sort of typed in her name, Kelsey Plum, and it was interesting to me to just see the sort of like the sports world, and not just the sports world, but just, you know, just people that you would never even think about were watching this and, like, tuning into this. And yeah, you know, it was people like, you know, Jay Inslee of, like, all people, and like Kobe Bryant. And, you know, I mean, truly, I was thinking, who am I going to see next year? You know, like, am I going to see, you know, like, Sharon Stone or Robert De Niro or, you know, just like, so, and literally, if I saw her name and like somebody, like, was commenting on it, I just retweeted. It was, I mean, that was fun.
And she wasn't, by the way, she wasn't even healthy. This is what she told ESPN.
During timeouts, like I said, I wasn't feeling very good, so I was kind of eating a lot of applesauce. So I think that kind of gave me the extra spark tonight.
Huh?
I think she
applesauce?
Just threw that in just to, you know, maybe make it sort of bigger than what it was. No. So
the great ones always say they weren't feeling well.
You know, right?
Michael Jordan used to do that.
The, like, sick game, right?
Yeah, the sick game.
And so we kidded her afterwards.
It's the mark of the elite athlete is the upset tummy.
You know, or, you know, where, you know, like, and and I kidded her about this, and she didn't even know what this reference was. But the Willis Reed reference, you know, like old people like us sort of know what that is, you know?
Vaguely.
You know, just sort of like
New York Knicks.
That's yeah, Knicks, and sort of, you know, wounded and going out and giving this phenomenal performance. But I think that she was legitimately not feeling well. You could see her on the sideline, just sort of, you know, just, yeah. And like at the time, you didn't know what was going on. Like, why is she sort of eating during like timeouts? But
because it's applesauce, that's why.
Yeah.
What makes Kelsey Plum so great in a nutshell?
You know, wow.
Because listeners might not even know, is she 7'6"? Is she like what is so great about her?
You know, and that's the thing there. And we could talk about this for hours, but you know, just in a nutshell, she's a 5'8" point guard. She's a kid from San Diego, mm-hmm. You know, or just outside of San Diego. I don't think she was like blessed with any type of great genes. Like, you know, like she didn't win the genetics lottery or like anything, you know, quite like that. I think she works really hard. I mean, just really, really hard. That like she has sort of crafted her game. Again, she's a shot maker. She doesn't, and she's not a gunner either. You know, she's very efficient. You know, she shoots 53% from the field and over 40% on three pointers. And you know,
she doesn't just throw the ball up and make 10 and miss 10.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, and so like she's really good that way. And you know, this is really kind of speaks to the corniness of sports, but she is sort of embodies that. If you put your mind to it, if you work hard enough that you can do, you know, almost anything you want. Now, I don't want to take that too far, that like if you and I put in the same work as like she, I don't think that we can score, you know, like, you know, 3,000 and like 900 points. I don't
speak for yourself.
Well, I'm speaking for you and I. Sure. But
you've played with me before.
Yes, I have. Yeah. But I do think that, you know, that if there was a way that we could sort of figure out what everybody's potential is, she has maximized or is maximizing, because I don't want to put any ceiling on her, that she is maximizing her potential and getting everything out of it.
Okay, so that's enough Kelsey Plum for now. For people who we got interested, she's playing at Key Arena this week in the Pac-12 tournament.
Sure.
Right? And Stanford and Oregon State, are they going to take special pleasure in pounding the Huskies in their scoring hot shot?
They will try. So you know, this week, you've got the Pac-12 tournament there. The defending champion is Oregon State, so they're going to be there. Stanford has won this thing, I want to say, like a gazillion times.
Let's say a gazillion,
you know, right? And so Washington has never won it, and so they're still somewhat of the upstart.
And then the NCAA tournament, the Huskies are going to be in that too. And like you said, she's Kelsey Plum, all-time scoring leader now. So good, you could almost forget that Chantel Osahor pulls 30 rebounds in a single game. Yeah. I mean, this is a pretty special team.
You know, it is a fun group with really great personalities. You know, not just Kelsey, not just Chantel, but there's also Katie Collier. I mean, just a phenomenal story there that we just don't really have time to really get into. Like a senior who has battled back from leukemia.
Jeez.
Leukemia.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. I mean, this young lady has overcome leukemia plus knee injuries, and then Heather Collier, Corral, you know, who like has had over 12 different injuries and like her. I mean, so a fun team, and the guy who kind of makes it all go, sort of like the mad scientist, is the coach, Mike Nabors, who's just as, if you never talk to him, you've got to talk to this dude.
Yeah.
You know, guy from Arkansas, great accent, but just even a better outlook on life and basketball. Just a really unique individual.
Okay, come talk to us, Mike Nabors, coach of the Huskies. Percy Allen, Seattle Times sports reporter. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for that. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Should we bring grizzly bears back to the North Cascades? We'll give you a couple of perspectives on that here in just under 10 minutes. But first, when President Trump gives his address tomorrow to a joint session of Congress, 19-year-old Kelty Pierce of Puyallup is going to be there in the audience listening for Trump's take on the Affordable Care Act. Kelty Pierce told KUOW's Amy Radel about her journey from daffodil princess to healthcare activist.
Being a daffodil princess in Pierce County is not about winning a pageant. Kelty Pierce is emphatic on that point. Instead, it's an award for high school girls devoted to public service. Pierce was one recipient, and that's how she met Representative Denny Heck.
And the congressman and his staff actually came to speak at one of our Saturday morning practices.
After this meeting, Heck gave Pierce a ticket to attend the president's speech in Washington, D.C., in order to spotlight her concerns over changes to the healthcare law. Pierce has had multiple surgeries over her lifetime to deal with hip dysplasia. She also has an inflammatory disease called ulcerative colitis, which requires expensive treatments. Pierce is using her life experience to talk to her fellow students at the University of Washington about the importance of having health coverage.
People don't look at me and assume, oh, she's sick. They see me out there involved in the Greek community, going to classes, going to our student government events.
She's making the case for health insurance to the young, healthy people around her. It's a demographic that often went without insurance before the Affordable Care Act. She tries to emphasize that her story could be anyone's.
You know, when I tell them that in 2016, I had 162 doctor's appointments while they were watching Netflix, you know, hanging out with friends or whatever, I think that's a powerful number, is because when you break it down, that's 3 or more on average a week.
The ACA allowed people like these students to stay on their parents' insurance plans up until age 26. It also requires insurance companies to cover pre-existing medical conditions. Pierce says it's encouraging to see Washington State's Republican members of Congress supporting those provisions, but she's not relaxing yet.
The truth is we don't have a clear plan, and it's not just the pre-existing condition piece that is huge for me and so many other Americans. Yes, I appreciate that they're saying they're committed to keeping people with pre-existing conditions protected. However, that does not include lifetime limits.
In our office, when we talk about health care, we're talking about repeal and replace, and it's going to happen.
That's Republican Congressman Dave Reichert in an interview last week on KCTS. In terms of lifetime limits, Reichert says Republicans are discussing a cap on benefits for one population, single able-bodied adults who received health care coverage through the expansion of Medicaid.
Those people will have an off-ramp. So 2 to 5 years, they'll be on an off-ramp and be gently moved to another insurance policy where they will receive either continued subsidies and or tax credits in order to afford and help pay for an insurance plan. No one is going to lose coverage.
Democratic Representative Denny Heck says it's clear Republicans want to keep certain parts of Obamacare, but he says the less popular mandate for everyone to buy insurance is what makes these provisions viable.
Even the Republicans say they like these things. They're enthusiastic about these things. These things are effectively funded by the individual mandate. Requiring people to participate or pay a penalty is what makes the pool large enough to be able to say to somebody with a pre-existing condition, you have a right to access to health care.
Reichert says the repeal and replace bill will be working its way through the House in the next few weeks. For Kelty Pierce's part, after her trip to the Capitol, she'll participate in a march for health care in Tacoma this weekend. Then, she says, her next task will be to pass her final exams. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. If you ever saw the movie Con Air, you know that high-risk prison inmates are sometimes moved around the country on charter flights. There's always the chance that Nicolas Cage and Steve Buscemi will go free. Well, it turns out the state of Washington has its own version of Con Air. KUOW's Austin Jenkins reports in collaboration with the News Tribune of Tacoma.
In the movie Con Air, inmates hijack a plane flying them to prison.
Welcome to Con Air.
In real life, prisoner transports sound more like this. This is a Washington State Patrol King Air taking off. Often, this twin-engine plane flies the governor. But on January 3, 2013, two Department of Corrections lieutenants headed to a tiny Northern California town. They were picking up a former Washington prison inmate who was on probation when he killed his girlfriend in Spokane and fled to California. Tony Callahan, who's now serving 20 years for that murder, recalls the day he was flown.
Basically, I was shackled and cuffed.
And warned.
And they said that they didn't, you know, want any crap out of me, is what they said.
He calls the experience kind of bizarre.
Here's this elaborate plane just to come and get, you know, me. And I was, and they said, well, we do this all the time.
Records show that between January of 2013 and September of 2016, the Washington Department of Corrections used State Patrol planes 9 times to transport 14 inmates. Some trips were to move problematic inmates to out-of-state prisons, but most flights were to pick up probation violators who had fled the state. The longest and most expensive King Air flight we found was to Florida in 2014 to pick up 2 probation violators. That round trip cost taxpayers $34,000.
We know it's more expensive for us.
That's David Flynn, who oversees inmate transportation for the Washington Department of Corrections. He says the state is legally obligated to retrieve probation violators, but usually they're brought back on commercial flights.
However, when we've gone through a thorough screening and we think there's a potential risk for the community, we err on the side of caution.
That means taking a private charter or the state-owned King Air. These flights are generally reserved for inmates deemed dangerous or mentally ill.
The potential for having something serious happening on a commercial flight, that exists, and that's the reason that we use King Air.
We checked with the Oregon Department of Corrections to find out if it charters planes to transport inmates. The answer was no. Inmates are moved by ground or commercial air, and sometimes by U.S. Marshals. So what happens when Washington probation violators are flown home? In the cases we reviewed, most of the inmates spent less than a month behind bars before they were released again. The Department of Corrections says that's because they've done their time, but not their probation. The reason for flying them home is to get them back on active supervision. The department first started flying inmates aboard state patrol planes in the late 1970s or early 80s. There was one hair-raising flight years ago. Jim Thatcher, now retired, remembers moving 3 prison gang leaders to Tennessee when one of the plane's engines flamed out over Scotts Bluff, Nebraska.
And we instantly dropped several hundred feet.
Thatcher says the pilots managed to land the crippled aircraft, but it took a week to get a new engine.
We were stuck in a small town with 3 of the most dangerous folks that we had.
Thatcher says the local sheriff came to the rescue and put the inmates up in his jail for free. In the decades that prisoners have been flown, we're told there's never been an escape. One retired state patrol pilot says he used to issue a pre-flight warning, act up, and he'd depressurize the plane. He says he never had a problem. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. There may now be fewer than 10 grizzly bears left in the North Cascades. That's according to government estimates. And some federal officials want to bring grizzlies back. U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the National Park Service have written a plan that has 4 possible options, and one of them is to capture grizzlies from surrounding areas and bring them here to the North Cascades. Bear expert Chris Morgan is a host of PBS Nature. He likes that option. Chris, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be here.
Chris, why? Why would you want humans closer to jaws and claws?
That's an interesting question. I think grizzly bears bring us something quite special in a world that lacks wild places these days, you know. I live in Bellingham, so I can see the mountains where a few of these grizzly bears live, but there aren't many of them there. And they've called it home for 20,000 years. We've done a pretty good job of wiping them out and pushing them into these high reaches of these inaccessible mountains, and that's where they sort of hang on by a thread. And if we brought them back, I think, you know, philosophically there's lots of reasons. People generally think that we should be preserving them for future generations and that they're part of our natural heritage and national heritage, you know.
Like bison in that way.
Yeah. We're in the Wild West, I think, you know. There's not much of that truly Wild West left, but there is here in the Cascades. And then, you know, on the practical side of things, they can be very good for the economy like they are in Yellowstone. So people who live in and around grizzly bear country can benefit from their presence. People love to come and see bears. And So for me, I think it's a really exciting opportunity for Washington State. Looking forward to this, you know.
Those sound very practical. Those reasons, heritage and the economy, and is that why you want to bring grizzly bears into the North Cascades?
Well, to me, they represent something wild. I have a very strong connection with them. A lot of time around grizzly bears. I see them as something that humbles us as human beings. I feel like in this world of rapid pace and confusion and overstimulation and information, you spend time in grizzly bear country, and when I do, it makes me a completely different person. It recalibrates me as a human being. And I think we all need a level of that. And that's not to say that everyone can take a hike in grizzly country, but it is to say that everyone would know that they are there, and sometimes that's enough.
Would you tell us more about that experience of being in their presence?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me, yeah, I'm there already in my mind just talking about it. I think, you know, when you're hiking down a trail and you know there are no grizzly bears there, or large carnivores in general, it's a different experience. I hike back in Scotland sometimes, in northern England where I'm from, and I find myself sometimes by accident shouting, "Hey bear, hey bear," you know, like you're supposed to do to stay safe on a trail. Mm. And then I remember there are no grizzlies there, and there haven't been for 1,000 years in Britain, but they used to be there. And there's something not there anymore, and it's not just the grizzly. It's this sense of something bigger, wilder, stronger, more in tune than we will ever be again with the natural world. And it makes you think in those ways, like a grizzly bear. When I'm out there, I tune into nature more. When I'm looking for a track, looking for scat, trying to figure out what a bear has been eating, why it's been in this place, how many bears were there, what direction were they moving, were they heading to or from a den, all kinds of things that you can kind of get this insight into the natural world through it, through the eyes of a bear. It's magic.
Have you come across a bear in the North Cascades?
I've not. I've come across...
Not a grizzly
anywhere.
Not
a grizzly. Yeah, lots of black bears in the North Cascades. And I've spent many, many hundreds, if not thousands of days looking for them in the Cascades. Mm. But I've been in a lot of grizzly bear country elsewhere, and a lot of time in grizzly bear country in Alaska. But even just feeling like that they might be there in the North Cascades is enough to get the sense that there's something special about the place.
So there are a couple of different plans to bring back bears to the North Cascades. One of them would be over a couple of decades, one over a 50-year period, another that could replace them over a century. What do you think is the right way to do this?
Well, I think whichever way is chosen by the government, and one of those alternatives, as they call them, of these four options, one of them is no action at all, just sort of the status quo. And that would mean that the bears walk to extinction, basically, whatever bears are left here. And then the other three are various levels of bringing them back. So I would favor option C, because it very much takes a sort of a slow, gradual approach to it. And looking at this ecosystem, the government and all the research that's been done shows that it could hold probably 200 grizzly bears here. But it'll take 100 years to get to that point. And so they're not going to, some people have asked me, so they're going to dump 200 grizzly bears in there? That's not the way it works. It would be 5 or 7 bears over 5 or 10 years in that particular option. So a very slow, gradual process. Captured in some places, really wild bears that don't want to have anything to do with people. Young bears that are ready to breed. Brought back into the Cascades and dumped in some incredibly wild areas, well away from people. And then monitored very carefully to see how they do. So there's a lot of big brains behind this that have done the research over the years to establish that this is the way to do it. And this has really been ongoing since 1975, when the grizzly bear was first listed on the endangered species list. So it's not something that just came up as a bright idea yesterday.
We're talking with Chris Morgan, a filmmaker, an expert on bears, and we're talking about the possibility of bringing more grizzly bears to the dwindling population in the North Cascades. So for a listener who wonders whether this makes the list of things to care about, you know, make the case. Why? There could be grizzly bears, there could be a lot, there could be a few. Why does it matter so much?
Well, I do think that this is a truly wild place in the North Cascades of Washington, and it's something that we could be very proud to restore. And the grizzly bear is the last of those iconic species that's not there in any good numbers right now. So imagine years from now when your kids and your grandkids and future generations look back and think, wow, thank you for doing that, for establishing this place where these big wild animals are safe. and where they have a rightful home and have had for 20,000 years, long before humans were here. So to me, it just feels like it's the right thing to do. To some people, it's not the right thing to do. And I do understand that some people have reservations. You know, people that operate and live in grizzly bear country are sometimes afraid of the bears. Sometimes they're afraid of big government. Sometimes they're afraid that their livelihoods are going to be impacted. And all those are genuine concerns for people to have. All that I would suggest is that people really base their opinion on the facts rather than the myths, and there are a lot of them out there, and I hear them every day.
So we have these proposals to boost the bear grizzly population in the North Cascades. What happens next, and what's your part in it?
So my part is really just being out here as somebody who's worked a lot with grizzly bears and knows them as an animal, and I like to think that I give accurate information to people when they ask me, and of course I'm an advocate and sound like it, but I like to think that I like humans as much as I like grizzly bears, and I've worked all around the world in places where it works really well. And you only have to look at Yellowstone National Park and see the number of people that go to see grizzly bears there. There's an amazing benefit to having these bears around, and not just the philosophical ones that I've talked about, but the real practical ones. I mean, millions of dollars pumped into that economy there from people going to see grizzly bears and wolves, but top of their list are grizzlies in Yellowstone. And so I think there are a number of different reasons for people to really jump on this and advocate for it. And it's I'm looking at the American flag behind you there on the wall. It's there's nothing more American and frontier and Wild West than a grizzly bear. They're on the flag of California, but there are no grizzly bears left in California. But there are here in Washington State, and that's pretty special in today's world.
How do you feel about the fact that in your lifetime we might not see, I don't know, 100 bears, 50 bears? I don't know. You know, you may never see a grizzly bear in the North Cascades. How do you look at this?
I may not, but I would love to. If I found a grizzly bear track in the North Cascades, it would be a life highlight, a true life highlight for me. I've done some crazy things around the world and seen some incredible sights. I've been very lucky, but if I saw a fresh grizzly bear track on a muddy trail going through the Cascades, it would make me very, very happy. And but if I don't, I'm fine with that. I think this is all about our future. And really, it's about our relationship with our planet. And unless we shift that needle a little bit as human beings, then the future's not going to look good for any of us, grizzlies or humans or any other wildlife species.
Chris Morgan, you can find him in the North Cascades looking for that fresh track. See him on PBS Nature. He's a filmmaker, a grizzly bear expert based in Bellingham. Thank you so much for this, Chris.
Thanks, Bill.
So there you go. You just heard a very passionate argument for bringing back the grizzlies. Not everybody who lives near the North Cascades is as excited as Chris Morgan. Kevin Ash is a former logger in that area. He now owns the only grocery store in the town of Darrington. Kevin, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What are your concerns with bringing grizzly bears back to the North Cascades?
Okay, well, first let me just say I'm not a grizzly bear hater. I mean, I fly every year to Alaska to go do some fishing on Admiralty Island, and, of course, they got lots of bears there, and I want to see them. But those are not endangered bears. The bears that were going to be imported into the North Cascades are going to be, in my understanding, going to be on the endangered species list. And we here in Darrington and a lot of communities up and down the Cascades have been through the endangered species things two or three times before.
You know, spotted owl.
Spotted owl, marble murrelet, the salmon habitat recovery. Mm-hmm. And what happened to us was we lost our economy. We lost our industry, which was timber.
Will you say a little more about what that has done to Darrington? You were in the logging industry when you were younger, and how has Darrington changed since that industry has declined?
Well, I mean, we are nowhere near the town that we were when we had a timber industry. We have a mill here in town, if you can believe this. I mean, we're surrounded by timber, old growth and second growth. So, but that there's we have the mill here in town gets no timber from around our area because of the spotted owl and the marble murrelet, and also salmon habitat. So, I mean, we're not economically we struggle. Our school district is shrinking. I mean, we're not the same town we were. I mean, at one time we were one of the healthiest school districts in the state because of the timber tax dollars that we were getting. And now that's dried up. That does not exist anymore.
Well, Kevin, our listeners have just heard Chris Morgan telling us what an economic driver the grizzly bear would be. Look at Yellowstone. What do you say to that?
Well, I've been to Yellowstone, and of course, when I went there, I wanted to see some bears. We weren't fortunate to see any. But that's a different topography than what you've got here. I mean, they say they're going to plant them or put them up in the high elevations of the North Cascades. So if they were to stay there, very few people would ever see them anyway. But we feel they're not going to stay there. They're smart. They're going to go where the food is. So some of these bears, if not all of them, are going to end up in the valley floors. Another huge difference between these bears and the bears in, say, Yellowstone or other places is we're right by a major metropolitan area here, up and down the I-5 corridor. I mean, it's not like, you know, in Yellowstone where, you know, you got some small towns around the park there. There's a lot of people around these areas.
What about a middle ground, Kevin? Is there a way to slowly introduce grizzlies in a way that takes the logging industry and these other concerns into consideration? Or are you just saying no more grizzly bears than the handful that are up there now?
Well, for me personally, if it wasn't for the Endangered Species Act, I might take a different course on this, you know, to look at it a little bit differently.
Finally, Kevin, any last words about people who might support bringing grizzlies back, something you want us to know?
Well, it's my understanding that the majority of the people that do want the bears brought back in the Cascades don't live out here in the Cascades. They live more in the larger cities, and that's fine. I mean, they have their right to express their opinion and voice their concerns, but they're not going to have to live with these bears like we are going to have to, like the small towns along the North Cascades ecosystem are going to have to. I mean, we're the ones that are going to have to deal with this. We're the ones that are dependent on these roads and trails and lakes and streams for our tourism, recreation. I mean, it's one thing for somebody, like say in Seattle, to be all for this, and it's a totally another thing for those of us who are actually out here living and trying to make a living, you know, in these areas.
We've been talking to Kevin Ash, who owns the only grocery store now in Darrington and a former logger himself, talking about the possible return of some grizzly bears to the North Cascades. Kevin, thanks for this conversation.
Well, thank you. I appreciate, you know, for allowing me to voice my concerns and my opinions. I appreciate that.
And in case you want to read that proposal to bring grizzlies back to the North Cascades, we're tweeting out a link now at KUOW. Keep in mind, the government is taking public comment on this idea until March 17th. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If you are pregnant today, you could get a test that would map the entire genome of your unborn child. And that map would tell you if your baby has Down syndrome or a gene that increases their odds of breast cancer or Alzheimer's. But new gene technology raises ethical questions. Science writer Bonnie Rockman examines those questions in her book Gene Machine, How Genetic Technologies Are Changing the Way We Have Kids and the kids we have. Rockman told me about people struggling with genetic testing, like Sophie Schieffer-Gold. Her son Isaac was born healthy, but then his health took a turn.
He was diagnosed with a disease called Canavan disease, and that particular disease is really, really terrible. When I met him, he was 14 months old. He couldn't sit up, and babies are able to do that.
Yeah, a year and 2 months.
Yeah. Well, I mean, much sooner than that.
Yeah.
He couldn't hold up his head.
Yeah.
So it's a neurological disorder caused by the lack of an enzyme that eats away at the white matter in the brain, and kids die young. Isaac died before he was two. And Sophie Schieffer was not screened for this disease, even though she is Ashkenazi Jewish of Eastern European heritage. And I tell the story in the book of how she wasn't screened for this disease because there's a lack of awareness among so many physicians about which tests are needed for which people, because for a long time, carrier screening has been done based on ethnicity. And even when it's done based on ethnicity, not all the same tests are offered to all the same people. So now there's a move to embrace something called expanded carrier screening, which is testing for a large number of diseases. That genetic technology now allows us to do that from the same blood sample and test for a large number of diseases and test all people for the same sorts of diseases, because we're such a melting pot these days that someone from Nigeria can be married to someone from Poland and they can have a baby and they, you know, bloodlines get muddled and mingled. It's like Madeleine Albright didn't know that she had Jewish heritage.
Yeah.
So relying on ethnicity is really an increasingly outdated approach.
And what do we know? Did you talk to the Gold family about what they might have done had they gotten that screening? Is it Canavan?
Yeah. Right. If they would have known, they would have had a couple of options. So they could have made embryos through IVF technology, assisted reproduction, and they could have actually screened those embryos to see which of them did not have the disease and then transfer only the healthy ones. So that is the technology that's available. Of course, it costs money and you can't make babies the way most people make babies. So you have to have the assistance of a fertility doctor. But it's a way to ensure that you will not pass on this genetic disease, this fatal genetic disease, to your children. Another option could have been for them to do prenatal testing during the pregnancy to find out if the baby had the disease, and then at that point, people, depending on their own personal moral convictions, sometimes decide not to continue a pregnancy, particularly in a case where it's a disease where the child won't have any kind of meaningful quality of life.
So the Gold's child died very early.
Yeah, it was really, really agonizing.
A year and a half.
Yeah, Sophie Schieffer was holding out hope that that Isaac would be different. There are some kids who do live into their teens, but they don't live into their teens unaffected, and they're wheelchair bound, and you really couldn't consider it a good quality of life. But he didn't even make it to preschool.
There are concerns with how much information we're able to get before we have a child. I'm thinking of the Down syndrome community, who's they're very, very concerned about what is it that they're most concerned about?
Well, there are new tests that have come online within the past 5-6 years. They're called non-invasive prenatal testing. And the way things used to be, you could only determine something like Down syndrome in the second trimester. And it was determined through an invasive test, something like an amniocentesis, a needle in the belly, or another procedure that can be done a bit earlier, but also has a very small but still present risk of miscarriage. And in any case, super unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So these non-invasive prenatal screens are non-invasive, so that a lot of people are excited about that. It's just a blood draw, and it's done around 10 weeks of pregnancy. So that is long before, or significantly before, most women are even showing. You can't even tell visibly that a woman is pregnant at that point.
And it's a highly reliable test.
That's a great question. It's very reliable, but the reliability shifts depending on age and some other factors. So, for example, if you would get a positive result, it would still need to be confirmed via one of these invasive tests. Oh. But it gives you a very good indication of whether your fetus has Down syndrome or a few other conditions. So, as you can imagine, people in the Down syndrome community, parents who have children with Down syndrome, were really concerned about that. They feel that as a society, we're more equipped than ever to welcome and to care for people who have Down syndrome. There is research going on. There are lots of resources. There's a lot of awareness about the importance of basically being good to people with special needs and having respect for people with special needs and incorporating them into schools, inclusion, immersion, all sorts of things like that. And so at the same time that if you're going to have Down syndrome, there's never been a better time. At the same moment, you now have these tests that are able to detect it earlier than ever in pregnancy, giving women the option to end their pregnancies sooner than ever. So you know, parents who have kids with Down syndrome are worried that their numbers of people with Down syndrome are going to shrink.
And even the idea that, oh, we're going to be able to weed out this terrible problem, that kind of runs counter to the idea of looking for who these people are instead of how they're different.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of people, it's a very personal decision. Every parent I have spoken to who has a child with Down syndrome doesn't consider Down syndrome to be a terrible problem. They love their child just the way he or she is. So, like so much of what I discuss in the book, this testing and what the testing can reveal, the calculations that arise because of this testing is very personal and very individual. Different people make different choices, and they might make different choices at different times in their life.
The book is Gene Machine, and it's written by a local science writer, Bonnie Rockman. How are these genetic tests changing parenting?
Well, it really depends on your mentality. So if you think about how you relate to information, what kind of person are you? Do you like a lot of information? If you're going out and you have to buy a washer and dryer, do you do tons of research and survey all your friends on Facebook and check out Consumer Reports for the past 12 months?
Some people are frozen by that.
Yes. And some people feel like, oh my God, too much information. I'm walking into Home Depot. Let me, the first thing I see, if they say it's good, I'll buy that. So they don't want all that information. They find it almost suffocating. So genetic testing and the evolution of all these tests and the availability of all these tests at every stage of pregnancy is really changing parenting because it is presenting parents with a lot of decisions that they have never had before. So when my mother gave birth to me 44 years ago, she had to go to the doctor for a pregnancy test. They didn't even have over-the-counter pregnancy tests. And then you wait for 9 months and see what you get. You didn't even know if it was a boy or a girl.
Yeah.
So there were really no decisions to be made. And so now the more access to information we have, the more decisions that have to be made. So as a result, some people actually decline all of this prenatal testing. They just don't. They don't want to deal with it.
So maybe it's not as simple as the coming screening and sequencing. It's not about whether it's good or bad. It really depends on what you do with it.
Yes, I completely agree with that. What one person thinks is good, another person thinks is bad. As is true with pretty much anything. You may like vanilla ice cream and I can't stand it. So it really, I think it just, you have to go into this with your eyes wide open. And I think that is one of the messages of the book, which is we're living in this incredible time, this incredible era of information where we have access to all this data that we have never had before about our children, both before they're born, during pregnancy, after they're born. And it's important to fully understand what you're getting into. So I put in a plug for genetic counselors who are really able to help people navigate all these new tests and understand the scope of what they might be signing up for.
And yet, I'm still curious about you, Bonnie, one person who you immersed yourself in all this information. Did you personally come away changed in how you look at parenting and birthing and our ability to know?
Well, as a journalist, I love information. I thrive on information. I don't find it overwhelming. I find it empowering. And I think that I've come away from all of this just really being awed by the potential and the power of science and of technology to help us peer into our genomes and those of our children. And the important thing is to go in with eyes wide open and to use this technology carefully and with an awareness of where red lines might be. So there's a lot of talk about a lot of concern over the potential for gene editing and genome editing in embryos or egg cells or sperm cells. And is that appropriate? And what would that mean? And I think that it's important to keep having these conversations about the human condition and how tests can help us gain insight into who we are and how our bodies function.
Local science writer Bonnie Rockman has written the book, The Gene Machine, How Genetic Technologies Are Changing the Way We Have Kids and the Kids We Have. And Bonnie will be speaking at Town Hall tomorrow night at 7:30, Town Hall, Seattle. Thanks for listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Are you drinking a canned sweetened coffee right now? Or maybe a Diet Coke? You may soon pay a new tax on that drink if Seattle's mayor has his way. Ed Murray is trying to join cities like New York in levying a soda tax. Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton, how would this tax work?
As I understand it, it would be levied at the distributor level. So it wouldn't be as if you go up to the counter at McDonald's and you say, I want a sugar Diet Coke, and then you get hit with 2 cents an ounce at the register. And so it would be very wide-ranging. It would hit Coke and Pepsi and also energy drinks, Gatorade, some fruit drinks. And it is pretty pricey compared to, say, the 1.5 cents an ounce in Philadelphia.
To me, 2 cents sounds a lot like 1.5 cents, but it adds up. Is that a big difference?
Well, it can be. I hear from people who are already complaining about higher prices at fast food outlets, and these tend to be the working poor. And we can be elite Seattle scolds and say, well, you should be drinking kale juice. But the reality is this is what a lot of people enjoy.
Yes, they enjoy it, but if it's stuff we don't need, I don't have to be a scold. I don't need extra sugar either, and the money is going for early education, right?
Well, it would depend on what those programs actually are and what their efficacy is. It's interesting to me how liberals have become so illiberal on things that they want to control people's lives in their way, in much the same way that conservatives want to control people's lives in other ways, but that's probably a discussion for another day.
Is it really controlling someone's life, though, to you put on a couple of cents on the distributor on something that we don't need more of? And well, let's talk about what the programs would be. How is it helping little kids?
Well, I think that it's been laid out in a way that it would work to lower the gap between white students and students of color, and that, of course, is a worthy goal, and we would need to see the details.
Other cities have soda taxes. I believe New York is one. Maybe there are others. Have we learned how well this works?
I think we're learning. New York is an extremely rich city. So is San Francisco. So are we. So if we can do this kind of an experiment, you can do it in a city like this as opposed to, no offense, Spokane or Tacoma. At the same time, they are preparing to start it in Philadelphia, and there's been warnings from the Philadelphia business community that this is going to cause layoffs in the beverage industry. It's going to cause layoffs at supermarkets. And a skeptic can say, well, that's just fear-mongering. But I think we're going to have to see. There's always winners and losers from any kind of economic action.
Is this part of a larger critique of yours, John, of the mayor of Seattle asking people to pay more and more and more?
Well, I don't want to put this all on him. I think he's in a difficult situation because he has an extremely progressive, let's say, city council. He has a city where the loudest voices are extremely to the left, and the others tend to get shouted down. And he has to manage all this in a way that doesn't either drive businesses out of Seattle, but at the same time address these constituencies. And this is not all cold calculation. I would take him at his word that he believes this is a good thing.
If the Seattle City Council passes this new soda tax, voters could theoretically repeal it if they don't like it. They could use a referendum. How do you think Seattle voters will react to this tax?
It's hard to know. I mean, the Seattle voters have put this group into power. And the people who actually vote have a lot of money. So if I want to go buy a Coke today, I can buy it. I won't even feel it. Not that journalists make a ton of money. But the people who will feel it the most are the ones least likely to vote.
John Talton is the economics columnist for the Seattle Times. John, thanks for this.
Thanks, Bill.
And finally, does Bill Gates think a hot dog is a sandwich? You've wondered, and now you know, because Gates didn't ask me anything on Reddit today. Quote, if you don't have a bun, then it absolutely is not. If you slice the hot dog and put it on a normal piece of bread like Burger Master, then it is. When you use a hot dog bun, then it is ambiguous. Bill Gates taking a break from curing malaria to tell you that. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle.